This is Chatter on Books because everyone should have a podcast. And here's your host, Victoria, or as we like to call it, Tori Claude.
We're going to get going with Chatter on Books, and someday Claude, the most important person in the show, is going to take all the stuff that we talk about before and after the show and put it together for some great outtakes, which will probably be better. Welcome back, everybody. We're Zooming, as ever. And in just a little bit, we'll be spending a lot of time talking with Alma Katsu, longtime Intel analyst, hotshot, incredibly talented fictional history writer, and someone who could take tragedies like the Titanic and the Donner Party and make them even scarier and weirder than they already are. And joining tonight, we do have Claude, who's in charge of all things. David Aldridge is back with us. And Angie Kim, author of Miracle Creek, one of our absolutely all-time favorite, most popular authors ever featured on Chatter on Books. Angie, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. That's so nice.
Yeah, no, I keep every email, I keep every little note. We've gotten quite a few. Oh, she was great. When is she coming back on? So, Angie, how are you and your family handling the pandemic? How are the boys, their music, their golf, et cetera? How's everybody doing?
Everybody's doing well. I have an 18-year-old who is off to college and who just graduated from high school, such as the graduation was or is or whatever. So that's a little weird. I have a 16-year-old who is going into his senior year in high school. So that's weird because all the SATs and ACTs and all that has been canceled. It's been a very strange time, especially for writing and all of that. My husband is, I think I told you guys last time, he is in a rock band.
Yeah.
He's a lead guitarist in a local cover band. And so all of their gigs, of course, have been, you know, canceled. And so they're going to try to start up with their rehearsals and practices in anticipation of like phase two reopening outside, you know, like those types of things, hopefully over the summer. And so, but it's been a really weird time for all of us, right? Don't you think?
It has. So we had two kids who graduated allegedly from college this year, and no graduations, no senior semester, those kinds of things. And they felt sorry for themselves for a little bit. And they were like, okay, get over yourselves, right? It could be far worse.
Yeah.
But the good news is those college seniors and those high school seniors are sharing this experience with literally millions of other people. It's not as though it's just them or it's just this small pocket that because of some tragedy just in one particular community. And I think five or 10 years from now, they're going to be telling great stories about how hilarious it was that they didn't have to take their SATs. They didn't have to do this. They didn't have to do that. I saw the father, a young friend of mine who was graduating from high school. I saw the father the other day, and this is his third of four girls, of which he is the father, the poor bastard. And he says, well, at least I didn't have to buy one of those stupid white dresses that she'll never wear again. So he was pretty happy with this.
Yeah. So I'm the opposite. I'm the mother with three boys.
Yeah. That's a lot of testosterone. So how did they get their energy out?
So one of them, I was telling you guys earlier in the pre-show, one of them is actually starting to work, and he's a golfer. So he's working outside as a golf supervisor, which I think basically means that you basically take all of the golf carts and clean them and, so I think that's what that means. But in any case, so I'm glad that he's getting a little vitamin D outside because I tell you for two months, he and the other boys were just inside and just Zooming with their friends and doing all this, you know, just basically like online nonstop. And it was a little scary there for a while.
Yes. And they're saying all the time now, it's the more you're outdoors, the more your windows are open, the safer you will be. So there's all of that. But my neighbor's kids are a little bit younger, high school. And my image of them is they're all hunched over. You know, this is it. This is the posture.
They are.
And the little hands.
They totally are.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, but David, that makes me think. This will be the only sports question I ask you today, I promise. Maybe.
You can ask any question you like, Tori.
It makes me think about what we're all missing and what we're all looking forward to. Mm-hmm. And given everything that's been going on for the last now 10 days, I guess 10 days, 2 weeks since George Floyd was killed, Roger Goodell.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting statement by Roger Goodell, NFL commissioner.
Yes.
Pretty likely that the NFL will be playing some games this fall.
Yes.
How likely it is that a lot more people will be taking a knee, question one. And will Roger Goodell ever take a knee with football players?
The second answer is no. The first question is a lot. It would have been that case anyway. I mean, Roger Goodell is never going to. Taking a knee would be essentially admitting that Colin Kaepernick was right and you were wrong. And
what's wrong with that?
He'll never do that. You'll notice the words Colin and Kaepernick did not come out of his mouth last week. And so until he says, we apologize to Colin Kaepernick for blackballing him out of the NFL the last 4 years, that then all of this sort of rings somewhat hollow to me. I think it's an in the moment kind of reaction to what a lot of his players, you know, went on social media. They put a video out that was very strong saying that, you know, you guys didn't take this seriously when we brought it up the last time, and you better take it seriously this time. And I think this is a, you know, the NFL is excellent at covering its own rear end and is doing so again this time, hoping, I think, that by the time September rolls around, everyone will have forgotten about this, which is the norm in this country. And then we'll be right back to players. Whoever takes a knee will be ostracized, blackballed, all that sort of thing. I hate to be that cynical, but that's what the NFL makes you do.
I can't imagine that happening. I really, really can't. I feel like it's so different right now. I feel like everything is, it just feels different about, you know, on social media, on Twitter, like people aren't, even the anonymous people who are, you know, who usually come on and say the ridiculous things that, you know, because they feel safe in their anonymity. I feel like even they aren't coming out as much that I've seen anyway.
Angie, I hope you're right. I really do. I hope you're right. But we talked about this last week. You know, I'm old enough to remember looking at a video of Rodney King getting beat up by five cops in LA going, well, this is going to change it. Everything's going to change after this. It's on tape. Right. They can't deny it. It's on tape. And it didn't change. So I hope it changes. I hope it does. I really do. I hope it does. But, you know, and especially when it comes to the NFL, if you told me any other sports league had really had a change of heart, had really thought about it, had really listened to its players and said, we're going to do things differently from now on, I would give them at least the benefit of the doubt. At least I'd let them show it, show me their actions. With the NFL, they've done nothing in 40 years to make me think anything other than this is a very kind of naked, obvious, and clumsy attempt to be on the right side of this issue. Because they've had, again, 4 years to say Colin Kaepernick's name, and they haven't. And they never do. And he was the guy that started all of this. So.
Totally.
One of the sad things my family has done during the pandemic is we watch and rewatch the Stanley Cup with the Caps, because, you know, we're all in for the Caps. We watch the Nets. We rewatch the games. We watch the final games. It's just so sad. And we just get just as excited watching them now as we did before.
Sure.
But we were talking about this, David, the other night, and we were saying, you know, if there was a hockey game tomorrow, we would bet people would come into the arena, if they could, and would take a knee. Right? It'd be a little crowded. You know, it's very cramped in those. I think timing's everything. I hope this doesn't go away. I hope these feelings don't go away. I hope the efforts that are occurring at the state and local level in a lot of places across the country, with the help of big names and big celebrities, as Angie was saying, with the help of them to add a lot of firepower to this, I think this one might be different.
Again, I hope so. I certainly hope so. I don't want to be cynical. I really do hope you're right. I really do. It would be better for all of us if you all are right. And maybe this is a sea change. And, you know, I think people are in the moment much maybe more affected by this and more willing to and more empathetic. It's just that the history kind of lends you to believe. I have a friend who's a dear friend of mine who's a history professor. And she says, the problem is when you read history, you realize, if you read up on history, you realize that it doesn't really, nothing really changes all that much over the course of time. So, and I was a history major too. So I'm kind of cynical about behaviors because they tend to repeat themselves over time. So hopefully this is this is something different, but you know,
I've always forgotten the expression, but there used to be this great line about if you really want people to pay attention to something, make it the national debate question of the year, right? You know, all the debate clubs have one big question. And similarly, when the driving factor of Joe Biden's vice presidential pick is where's this person on police procedures and police brutality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said he wants a woman, and it's very likely now it's going to be an African-American. Mm-hmm. That's a good sign. That's a very good sign at the highest of levels.
Sure. Look, but that's, I don't mean that nothing has changed. I'm not saying that. I know that a lot has changed, certainly in the course of my lifetime. Sure, a lot has changed. But fundamental things tend to take longer.
Yeah.
And the issue of will we give the police the authority in our name to discipline and otherwise keep Black people in line? That hasn't changed in about 300 years, you know, regardless of what you call it. You know, you can call it different things, but it is still the authority of the state as given by the people to discipline other people.
Yeah.
And that has never changed. And it hasn't changed, you know, regardless of anti-lynching laws and all that sort of thing. You still have police acting in the name of the public, disciplining men and women of color in these kind of outsized, egregious ways.
Somebody,
I totally agree, because I was just citing to my kids last night, we were just talking about this last night, I was citing the Rodney King as, you know, that was, you know, that was a moment that we thought everything would change, because now we have video. That was a big thing. That was different. But then, like, we have had more and more videos crop up like every couple of months. And so what is different? But something does feel different about it. And one thing that I think has come about just in the last couple of days is this, you know, the call to, you know, get rid of and defund the police department.
Right.
And it's so interesting, because I know that a lot of mayors of a lot of these cities that have had issues have had issues with, you know, the union contracts that are really entrenched. And the defunding debate is, I feel like that's something that I, 2 years ago, a year ago, wouldn't have even been something that you could discuss rationally. And I feel like the fact that it's actually even up for debate is a huge thing that I don't think would have happened in the Rodney King days 20 years ago or whenever that was.
And when schools and universities across the country are saying they've already acted on this, no more off-duty cops policing our campuses.
Right.
Now, they may come to regret that because they want the security, but that's a sign that people are actually taking steps, versus, to your very well-founded point, David, oh, we scream, we yell, we say never again, these kinds of things, and then we all go back to our lives. This one, there seems to be one, there's more diversity, to use you know, a word in expertly, there's more diversity of the people that are doing things. And secondly, they're actually doing things. And it happens, it has to happen at every level, but things are happening.
I you know, I would, if there was national leadership on this issue, I would tend to be more optimistic. if there were people
in
positions of who have the moral suasion and the soapbox to get up and say, we're going to change this. Look, I've always said this, you know, history is a series of accidents, right? And things that no one either expected or even wanted, right? Nobody wanted John Kennedy to be assassinated, right? Nobody did. But the only way that the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Bill passed in 1964 and 1965 is because Lyndon Johnson was president.
Right.
It would have never passed if John Kennedy were still president, because he did not have the ability to get people in the South to agree with him on this.
Yeah.
Only Lyndon Johnson had the ability to do that, right? And so that was a happy, unhappy accident, right, of history. And so, but it required a president to get up and say in a speech to the nation with both chambers of Congress in present to say, we shall overcome. That's what changed it, okay? Well, that was what got the ball rolling towards those things passing. And so until you have that, I don't know that you're going to have the kind of meaningfulness.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Now, I have not followed the news closely today, but I've heard that some national leader might be having a big speech on unity. And oh, my God.
Good luck with that.
Wait, I have a pop quiz for you guys. But before we get to the pop quiz, Angie, there have been wonderful developments with Miracle Creek. You're absolutely fabulous.
About
last time you were on the show. Already won the Edgar Award, right? Mystery Writers Award.
Yes, I'm so excited.
And then
tell us about
the Anthony Award, which is another big one. And Alma tipped me off earlier today.
Yeah. I just actually found out about it today, as because I was like, why do I have 78 Twitter notifications or whatever? I was like, what is happening? And like over 100 Facebook. And so Anthony Awards is presented at the BoucherCon conference every year. And so Miracle Creek is one of the five best debut novel finalists. So I'm
That's
really, really
awesome.
Excited.
Congratulations.
And this, and unlike the Edgars, what's fun about the Anthony Awards is that it's judged by by voting of the people who belong
wow.
to, you know, the mystery. So it's like, it's wonderful in some sense because it's done by vote by your peers, by
yeah.
other writers, which
yeah.
I think is just so, which is what makes it so special. So
that's fabulous.
Yay. So I'm really excited.
Where is Miracle Creek
Yay.
In terms of the movie that we all planned and cast and everything else?
So I think I can't remember if I told you guys or not, but Paramount had bought it and optioned
Yay.
It. So I'm excited. So it is, you know, we're in the middle of getting the pilot. It's for a limited TV series rather than the movie,
which
I think is the right
watching.
Thing.
Yeah,
which I love. And yeah, and there's seven point of view characters. So like an 8-episode or 9-episode arc would be great because then you could really devote
yeah.
each episode to each character. And I think that would be really, really wonderful. So I'm really excited. And I'm really excited to actually see the script. So yay.
You might be. I don't know if I told the story when you were on the show or somebody else, but I used to work
okay.
with Chris Buckley, wonderful guy, who wrote all sorts of fabulous books. And he wrote Thank You for Smoking, just very funny, satirical take on the gun and the smoking and the liquor lobbyists. And
mm-hmm.
it was a great book. Sold like crazy, immediately gets optioned for a movie. And then whoever was writing the screenplay, I can't remember who it was, calls him up and says, I'm the guy who's going to F up your great book. And Chris
oh,
was
no.
kind of taken aback. But you just, you know, different people can strike different kind of deals. But that's when Chris realized you have absolutely no control. So you might like where they take
oh,
it.
Oh, no. Yeah, no, there's absolutely no control. And in fact, I remember when we were doing the negotiations, I was like, oh, could I have no desire to actually write the screenplay, but could I maybe like be a fly on the wall in the writer's room just to sort of like see how it works? Because I think that would be really fun. Like, don't
yeah.
you think that would be fun?
Will they
to
let
sort of
you?
See how the Hollywood, so I got a producer credit so that they'll let me, I think I can say, can I please come? And they would
awesome.
Have to let me. I hope, I don't know.
Awesome.
Who knows?
Is there a time yeah. frame on this? Do we know when we
No,
might...
I don't think so. I mean, we have a showrunner and a screenwriter and things like that. So I think things are sort of nebulous as far as timing on
yeah.
everything these days because of
sure.
COVID-19. I mean, it's so hard to know exactly
yeah.
what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But speaking of Hollywood, okay, so I had this thought like 5 minutes ago and then I completely forgot about it. So I don't know if this happens to you guys, but it happens to me all the time. But David, I had a question for you. Which is, okay, since we were talking about like NFL and this isn't NFL, it's NBA, but all right. So now that we're talking about like Hollywood and movies and blah, 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 blah. So I feel like, what was it, 3 weeks ago, we were all talking about the Michael Jordan documentary, or
yes.
at least we were in my house because we're all, my husband went to UNC. And so we
right.
go down to North Carolina and we, you know, like watch all the basketball games. My kids are like fanatics and blah, blah, blah. So I feel like that was all anybody I know was talking about.
Yeah.
And there's nothing about, like, it's like we've forgotten about it. So we're talking, just like we were talking about the short attention span.
Right.
Is that just my world or is that like the world at large?
No, it's the world at large.
Right?
I think it was there. I mean, it's like, this is my point about the NFL is that they're playing the long
yeah.
game. They're saying, we're going to talk about it now. So
yeah.
that by September, nobody will remember what they were mad about. And so,
mm.
yeah, I mean, no, I think that's everybody. And, you know, things are... the shelf life of anything is half a second, you know, these days.
Right.
And then you're on to the next thing. I mean, you literally, when I was doing TV, they would tell us, you literally have about 32 seconds to get somebody's attention and hold it and keep it. Otherwise, they're changing the channel.
Yeah.
that's really true. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
But The Last Dance, as we talked, it crossed so many boundaries. It captured
different
people, including, and I think the greatest thing that ever happened to it was the pandemic, because families like ours were desperately looking for something to watch. It was a point of television, and we loved it. We wanted the Lance Armstrong one on 30 for 30 to be as good. Not as good.
It was fine, but it wasn't as good. I agree. Yeah. But that's because Lance is not as sympathetic a figure also. People don't really want to watch 4 hours of Lance talking about taking steroids. He's not a good guy. No. Yeah, he's not a good guy.
No, when he's asked, would you do it all over again? And I'm paraphrasing, but would you do it all over again? Would you cheat again? Even though you know it's wrong, even though it probably gave you cancer, he's like, yeah.
Probably would. Exactly.
Okay.
Michael Jordan said the same thing about all the stuff that he did.
There's a Venn diagram in which they overlap each other quite a bit.
Totally. Oh, completely.
A lot of overlap. Completely. But Michael is at least charming at times, you know.
You're right.
Even when Lance Armstrong was trying to be charming, he was not charming.
He's not charming. He can't be charming. He's not capable.
I know. He's not.
All right. We want to get to Alma and talk about The Deep and The Hunger and everything else.
Yes. But
Alma, we got a pop quiz first. We got a very quick pop quiz. So, because I steal things all the time, I'm going to hold this up just for you guys, not that this is on. So this is from the New York Times. And one of the things that has fascinated me during the pandemic is that whenever somebody appears on television, it might be a journalist on one of the cable networks, it might be David talking about it, they always have the carefully curated bookshelf behind them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people are always looking at what can we learn and these kinds of things. So what they did is, this was called, because I don't want to really be accused of plagiarizing too much, what do famous people's bookshelves reveal? So I'm going to give you guys, Alma, you can play if you want. I'm going to give you guys three celebrities. And then have to guess whose bookshelf that was on. So here are the three celebrities.
Okay.
Cate Blanchett, spectacular actress.
Okay.
Stacey Abrams, might be vice president.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Prince Charles.
Okay.
All right. So here's the book.
Okay.
The Night Tiger by Yangtze Chu, set in 1930s colonial Malaya. You probably know this book, Angie.
I know this book. I love this book.
Okay. This 2019 novel, you've got to stay with me on this for the ending, is the kind of book reviewers like to call sumptuous, with a plot featuring the search for a severed finger and a supernatural tiger. So of Prince Charles, Stacey Abrams, and Cate Blanchett, on whose bookshelf? Alma, I'm going to go to you first. On whose bookshelf would that book have appeared?
Boy, you'd think almost anybody. I guess Cate Blanchett would be the safe choice.
Mm-hmm. I'm going Blanchett.
Okay.
I was going to say Blanchett, but I'm going to say Stacey Abrams just to, be...
Angie wins.
What?
Yay!
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm really surprised and very happy to see that on the bookshelf behind Stacey Abrams. Because most politicians talk about torture. Most politicians and their staff would go out and buy books to make sure they had their politically correct books on it. So anything that involves a severed finger. Okay, here are your three next celebrities.
Okay.
Amy Poehler, Paul Rudd, and Jane Goodall, the anthropologist.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's kind of a nice mix. So here's the book, The Hidden Target by Helen McGinnis. This 1980 spy novel tells the story of an American college student on a world tour who becomes entangled with secret agents looking to stop a terrorist plot.
Okay. I'm guessing.
And it's Amy. Who was the second one? Amy Poehler and Rudd.
Paul Rudd. Remember Paul Rudd?
I love Paul Rudd. Oh my God.
All right, Angie.
Angie
has to go first.
Okay.
We're in reverse order. Angie, you have to go first.
I can't imagine Amy Poehler or Paul Rudd. Oh, maybe Paul Rudd, because I've heard that he has a really eclectic taste.
Okay,
I'll say Paul Rudd. I'm going to say Paul Rudd.
David?
I am going to say Amy Poehler just so we have choices.
Okay. And Alma, what do you think?
I was going to say Paul Rudd, too.
You're all wrong. Jane Goodall, which I love.
Really?
Yeah.
I would not have guessed that. Wow.
Yeah, now this one, they listed two books for Jane. Now this one you would have guessed, The End of Food. Danger abounds at the grocery store.
Yeah.
In this 2006 expose of our current method of food production. reveals that the vitamin and nutritional content of food is in shocking decline. So there you go. I love that. But that makes me, it gives me great hope about Stacey Abrams.
Yes.
She was cool enough to have
Stacey Abrams.
Yes.
I love that.
I agree.
She was on Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is the third best show after this show and the Tony Kornheiser show. she was on Wait, Don't Tell Me maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, and she was spectacular. Mm-hmm. And that's hard to do. To be funny and smart and self-deprecating. Right. She was good. Okay. Yeah. Alma, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Good. Thank you for being with us.
Yes.
Well, thank
you. Yeah. So I want to give a little bit of the backstory, but then hear more from you. So you're from, I watched some of your interviews. You're from a creepy New England town with lots of cemeteries.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, it is.
That's funny.
What New England town was this? And we'll stay away.
Oh, well, it's the name of the town is Maynard. It's Maynard, Massachusetts. And it's sort of nestled in the Concord, Lexington area.
Okay.
So, you know, old colonial, but definitely the wrong side of the tracks from Concord. Yeah.
Why so many cemeteries?
I don't know. It's a tiny, tiny town. And you just can't go. I mean, that's one of the first memories I have of it. My family rolling into town at night. My father had just retired from the military and he was returning to the area, you know, that he had grown up in. And we're rolling into town and it's late at night and I'm lying in the back of the station wagon looking out the windows. We're going by all these like iron fences with chains wrapped around gates. Yeah, just super creepy. Thinking, why the hell are we moving here?
And is that what made you an Edgar Allan Poe fan?
You know, I definitely think growing up there had something to do with it. But the other thing I often say, and maybe it's politically incorrect, is also I was raised Roman Catholic. Which is very, strange.
Yeah. 2 hours on that.
So that had a lot to do with it, too.
Yeah, definitely.
I was just telling, I was born and raised Catholic, at least through eighth grade. And I was telling somebody the story the other day. I was not far after Vatican II. And the principal of the school was Sister Arnold. That's all you need to know. That was her name. And she regularly paddled kids in the school.
Hello.
With a paddle tennis racket.
Wow.
A paddle tennis racket, which is hard and it's wooden. It has holes in it. So there's no wind resistance between your backside and the racket.
Did it have a nickname?
It probably did. But you would, hypothetically speaking, one would be called to Sister Arnold's office and she would turn on the PA system for all eight grades and announce who was in her office, why they were being paddled. And then she would proceed to paddle them over the PA system for the entire school to hear.
How
sick is that?
It really is. I mean, I think everyone who goes to Catholic school, and I did spend 4 years in Catholic school, has some stories.
Painful.
And I mean, you know, I don't want to say ill of women who join religious orders. But you know, it just makes you wonder about, you know, but it's all so strange. Okay, I better stop talking.
Okay, stop there. Okay. But so you're
because my aunt is my aunt in Korea, who's still in Korea, is a nun. So and I actually spent a summer with her when I was a preteen because I really wanted to do this. I thought that was like just very glamorous. Like to me, being a nun was like the height of glamour. I don't know.
Wow.
But anyway, so yes, I spent a summer with her and I thought it was just so like amazing and peaceful and whatever. And so I went to a Catholic school. Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway. Yeah.
Glamour is not the word I would have gone for, but you're the writer. So we'll let you know that.
Yes, I know. I know. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Alma, why did you become an Intel analyst? Which you've been for over 30 years.
Yeah, I had a whole career in it. I never intended to do it. You know, the short of it is, you know, when you're young and you say, I want to be a novelist, everyone tells you, well, you need to have something to write about, right? You need to have an exciting life. And here I was having this very dull life in Boston. And somebody said, oh, you know what you should do? You should take the test for NSA because it's so strange and NSA is, and they had all these crazy stories about NSA. And, you know, this was way before the internet and nobody in that I knew in Massachusetts knew anything about NSA. So I took the test with just the intention of getting that experience, but I tested well. And when they offered me the job, we were in the midst of a recession in this country, and I wasn't sure I'd be able to hang on to the job I had. So I did take it, and it enabled me to move down to DC. And I kept telling them, you know, we're only going to stay a few years.
Right.
And then here I was, I retired with 34 years in, and, there's a lot to talk about there. It was a fascinating career and definitely a life I would have never had, you know, the opportunities, you know, really test you in very unexpected ways. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it does have its drawbacks too.
What's the craziest thing you can tell us that you're allowed to tell us? Craziest thing that happened in your time?
Oh my God, there's so much. I don't think the craziest things I can't tell you, but it's very exciting. So one of the main things,
you know, for those who can't see, Alma just crossed her arms very defensively in front of her.
Yeah, sorry. Because there's just so many interesting things. So the funny thing is, you know, Angie was talking about her Hollywood experience, and my next book is going to be the first spy novel, and it's just about to go out on submission. So for film rights. And the agent has been coaching me on like how to put the artist statement together. And so she's really pushing me to put, you know, all these crazy, exciting things that have happened to me. And, you know, you spend your whole life being told, no, 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 you can't talk about what you do or yourself or whatever.
Right. So,
you asked that question and I'm just like, I've been beating myself up for days over this now, but I mean, it's crazy. I've probably the main thing is, you know, I was raised to think I was not a very scientific or mathematical thinker. And it wasn't until, so NSA is an extremely technical agency. And I did work at CIA too, but I started at NSA. Right. And I learned there that I actually have a very good technical mind. So, you know, there's a lot of things I could credit, you know, they just throw everything at you and you have to do as much as you can.
So you do historical fiction. Mm-hmm. And from what I've seen and what I've read and our other Chatter on Books favorite, Lewis Bayard, talks about how you impeccably
Lou, I love Lou.
Lou just, I mean, Lou was all spent months getting ready for the Penn awards and it got blown up by the pandemic,
so sad.
He's recovering. But you have to do tons of research for these books, whether it's the Donner Party, Alma, or it's the Titanic, the Deep we'll talk about. How did your work as an analyst and your work at Intel help you do the research? Because it had to have been massive amounts of research.
It is. And this is where I just sound like a utter jerk, but
You're good company. You're
Stop it. You're not a jerk.
Yeah. 30 years in intelligence, well, primarily as a researcher, you learn a few things. So, you know, I think I'm a very good researcher. And so, you know, you just learn techniques to kind of make it easier on you. So research does not daunt me. I mean, I started out as an analyst. By the end of it, I was the director of one of the Defense Department's research labs. Right. You know, so a big research project does not frighten me.
Daunting.
Yeah, not daunting. So like doing the research for the Donner Party was, you know, was a piece of cake. It wasn't a small task, but, you know, pretty, but I did kind of like suck in my breath and wonder, do I really want to do the Titanic? Because it was exponentially bigger.
So the Donner Party was approximately 100 people, right?
Yep.
And Titanic, 1500 people.
Yes.
Right?
Also, most people have heard of the Donner Party, but you don't really have like legions of Donner Party fans.
Right.
Titanic, you have all these rabid Titanic fans who, you know, if you get something wrong, are going to come after you with pitchforks and torches, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Can I ask her about the piece of wood?
Go for it. Yes.
Oh no!
I'm kidding. No, it's just a movie. There was plenty of room for both of them on the piece of wood. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Oh, yes, please.
Right.
Definitely.
Sorry.
Everyone knows that.
Definitely plenty of room.
Right.
Everybody knows that.
Yeah. There is because this is what pandemics do to you. I actually look at TikTok, which is just horrific. And I swear to God, it's all the animal videos. But there's a very funny one of dogs hanging onto a piece of wood in water to prove that Rose had wanted Jack to survive. Okay, but why the Titanic, Alma? Why the story? Because it has been gone over. The Titanic has been done a lot of times in a lot of different ways. What drove you? Because you weren't a Titanic groupie, I heard.
Right. I was not one of those kids that adore the Titanic. You know, the movie came much later in my life. So, you know, I just didn't get caught up in that romanticism. This is going to sound terrible, but, you know, I was very lucky with The Hunger. It did very well, got a lot of acclaim. But then once, as Angie knows, once you do a book, I'm sure you're going through this now, you kind of get set on this track. So people kept asking, what's the next disaster book going to be? You know, and in my other life, I actually did a lot of work as an analyst on disasters, mostly humanitarian disasters, but also natural disasters, genocides and mass atrocities. Yes, I'll get the fun part out of the way there. And so, yeah, I knew a lot about historic disasters. And it puts you in this weird position of judging, like, is it a big enough disaster for you to use? Did enough people die?
You know,
does it hit the right notes? One day my husband was watching a documentary on these divers that were going down to the Britannic and then said, you know, and this was the sister ship of the Titanic and it also sank. And I was like, that's interesting. And I sat down and then they said, and there was a woman who survived both sinkings. And I was like, I don't even have to know her story. There is a book in there.
I didn't know that.
Luckiest person in history.
I love that. Yeah.
I knew about the Britannic, the sister ship. I did not know a woman had served on both of them, which is insane.
That is insane. You would think that after you've gone through one, you would just stay away from all of them.
I'm out.
Right?
Yeah.
Like,
right. I'll just fly on the Zeppelin.
Yeah, right. You know, so that's what I'm finding is, you know, it's really interesting to go back and really learn the history because it always challenges what are our more modern, you know, notions of how we should live our lives and that sort of thing. So, for instance, with this, one of the things I learned was, you know, ship disasters were very common. And that's because ships are the planes of then, right? That's how so much transportation was done. Everybody who served on ships generally was in at least one accident a year. So, for instance, there was a guy, John March Starr, who was on the Titanic when it sank, and he perished. But he had been working for 8 years and was on eight different ships, and every single one of them was in an accident. So it wasn't as uncommon as you might think. The same thing. I'll just be cheerful with cannibalism, which I learned researching the Donner Party book, is it wasn't as uncommon back then as you might think. And that was because of this law of the sea that in a shipwreck, part of the law of the sea was if you needed to, you could eat one of your deceased, you know, people in the lifeboat.
Wow.
Well, it's just very practical. I mean, you have to go for practicality and survival. And
right.
Things, you know?
So,
what are you going to do?
Stories of shipwrecks and people who, you know, of cannibalism fairly regularly in the newspaper. So it wasn't as shocking back then when the Donner Party, when that incident happened, as it is to us today.
You've supernatural comes through all your books. And so here, you're this smart, incredibly disciplined, research-focused intel analyst. How does supernatural work in your world? How do you bring this in? And there are ghosts in the deep, which is, again, I'm a Titanic groupie, and I've watched everything, read everything. My sister was in the musical Titanic, and if you haven't had an out-of-body, you're watching people singing and dancing about the Titanic, which is bizarre. But what causes you, what's in you that wanted to bring the supernatural into these stories?
Well, I think that's kind of just where I started. You know, when I've been writing most of my life, I did take a big detour from once I started in the intelligence business, because they don't really like you writing on the outside, even if it has nothing to do with what you do.
So
So I took a big hiatus for 15, 20 years. But when I started writing, I was very, you know, taken with speculative fiction like Edgar Allan Poe and that sort of thing. It really got me early. Then there was the Catholic thing. You know, you're always in these creepy, over-decorated churches with a lot of statues. And, you know, so the combination, it just makes you want to believe in magic and that there's another part of life. That you don't know and maybe can change your life in ways that you know you have no control over. But anyway, and like you said, though, as you get more experience, you get older, especially as, you know, as you see how really terrible the world can be and no magic's saving these people, it does get beaten out of you. But I still like, you know, to have those elements in the story.
Ah, that's very Stephen King of you. I said, no, isn't that a big Stephen King thing? Where he wants to believe.
Yeah.
And if you haven't watched The Outsider during the pandemic, watch it and you'll never sleep again.
Oh, yeah.
Terrifying.
Yeah. They did an amazing job with that too.
Yeah. But a common thread in his stuff is, well, maybe there is something else going on here. And I think he treats it rather optimistically rather than pessimistically, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of what I enjoy about writing that stuff is just that suspension of disbelief, right? If I can, you know, make people who are very grounded in, you know, normalcy and what we expect out of the world still maybe hold out a glimmer of hope for something magical happening. So that's always fun.
Very cool. Well, everyone should read the book. Everyone should read this book, The Deep. Everyone should read The Hunger. Fabulous, fabulous. And hopefully buy it at your local independent bookstores. Okay, let me get you out with this, Alma. And then I'm going to ask Angie and David to answer this as well, to combine what we're all going through now. If and when you write an historical fiction book about the pandemic, what's the storyline? Where would you take it?
I don't know. I need to reflect on it. So one of the things I do when I look at an historical event, because I don't like just do another version of what actually happened. You know, I always try to do a reimagining. And so I look for, like, what were the big societal themes at the time? And then see, does it still resonate for modern people? So, for instance, with The Deep, what was the two biggest things that were going on at the time were, you know, women's rights, and then also income and class disparity, which, I don't know, might, you know, ring a bell with some people today, right? So, you know, so I just have to really think about what's going on societally for the pandemic. I mean, I know it seems pretty obvious, but who knows? Maybe in a few years.
Yeah. Okay, Angie, where would you take it? Where would you take the pandemic story?
I don't know. There's a couple of things. One is I really love this idea of like a sealed in, you know, where you can't escape a setting, you know. So in my novel Miracle Creek, I had, you know, this H-spot chamber where people were sealed in and you can't, and all the feelings swirling. And one thing that I'm hearing from a lot of people and reading a lot about is the fact that, you know, when you are sealed into your house and you can't really escape, and what that does to the relationships that you have with your own family. And I really think that's I think there's a lot of humor that you can mine from it, and as well as, you know, the conflict and tension. So I'm really, I think that could be really, really interesting.
I love
and
that.
And then and this isn't mine, but I've been reading a lot of like pandemic related things because that's all I can really like focus on right now. Mm-hmm. And there's one book that I'm obsessed with, and it came out 2 years ago. It's called Severance by Ling Ma. Hmm. And it's amazing. And I think it was shortlisted for many, many prizes and won the Kirkus Prize and things like that. But in any case, one cool thing about it is it's basically about an illness sort of like like COVID-19, and it's taking place in New York City, and it's much more virulent than, you know, COVID-19, so a lot more people are dead and things like that. And it's really about a woman going through the city and the empty city and the emptiness and sort of trying to capture the feeling of that. And it's really so powerful. And just that imagery of these places that used to be populated that are no longer populated is another thing that just this book really brought to mind. And I just keep on having these vivid dreams about it. So that's the other thing.
Oh, vivid dreams. Everybody's having vivid dreams, the pandemic. Okay, David.
Yeah, right.
David, because you write nothing but nonfiction, what would it be?
I am fascinated by the notion of people who never or who don't act in their own self-interest. And this has been a political question for many years, but But now it's almost a spiritual question to me. And so the notion that there are people that are not only willing, but want to go out without a mask on. They want to congregate with people. They want to be with other people. They want to hug people. They want to do all these things mm-hmm. when they know it will kill them.
Yeah.
And they do it anyway. And I just wonder about what I view as a disconnect, but which to them seems, I would think, to be a very rational thing. And I'm kind of curious about how do you arrive at that point where you do things that you know are bad for you. And I'm not talking about theoretically bad. I'm talking about like actually will kill you. Like yeah. there's no doubt. There's no argument about this. If you're around people who have this, you'll get it and it can kill you. You know, now that yeah. to me leads to certain choices, but to other people, they're taking different looks at it. And I'd be very curious to do a story about someone who just does that. As an article of faith, and what drives them to that place where they are willing to ignore all the science. They do not even believe the science in many mm-hmm. cases, and they simply take it as faith. And I'm not even talking about political faith. I'm just talking about faith.
Faith. Yeah.
That they don't think this thing that kills people
right.
will kill them.
Yeah. Will kill them, exactly. Yeah. So I was going to say, don't you think it's an invincibility thing? It's like, okay,
totally.
So as the mom of three boys,
right.
you know, who are 12 to 18, you. There's that invincibility factor where
sure.
like, you're like, yeah, this sure it's happening to other people, but it's not happening to me.
Right.
And if they yeah. actually thought that it might happen to them, you know that those people would be the first ones in line to do
maybe,
whatever they
but
could.
I'm not sure about that because it's not just 23-year-olds who have this kind of attitude. If it was just
right,
you know,
I meant like
millennials.
Yeah. No,
and
I'm right.
You know what I mean?
No, it's people, yeah, but it's people with like the, I guess I look at those people who have this attitude as like sort of similar to my, you know, my 17 and 16 year old, like they're, and they have that same brain yeah. mentality, whatever.
Yeah, great.
I'm just curious about it. I'm just curious why, how did you get there? How did you arrive at that?
Yeah.
That life yeah. kind of force. I'm just curious.
Do you admire it? Are you envious of it?
I'm just curious about it. Like
yeah.
I'm a very rational person. If somebody says you have a 10% better chance of living if you do this, I tend to do that.
Right.
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 And
right.
so, you know, I'm just kind of rational about things. And it's not that they're irrational. I'm not saying that. They think it's very rational what they're doing. I think
sure.
some of them do.
But
and I'm just curious about how they get there, how they arrive at that place where they feel that way.
Guys, this is fabulous. We could go on forever, but we got to wrap this up. I promise Claude, I actually let him have a life after this. Everybody, Claude, thank you for making everything happen. Angie, so good to see you again. Good luck with Miracle Creek.
We'll yes. look so happy to be here again.
So fantastic.
Little screens. Alma, fabulous to meet you and hear about you. Everyone should get the deep. Everyone should get the hunger. What's the next one, Alma, you told me, and I forgot. What's the next
one? The spy novel is called Red Widow. It's
That's
coming
right.
out next spring.
Ooh, nice
okay.
name. Good name.
Excellent.
Ooh,
so come back.
The title, yeah.
Come back and talk to us about that one.
Thank
and
you. I'd love to.
Everybody out there, hope you stay safe. Next week, we come back with Frank Wilderson. I don't know how many of you ever heard of Frank Wilderson, but I read this great interview with him in the New York Times about probably 3 or 4 months ago. This brilliant guy who's now at UC Irvine. Long story short, born and raised in the United States, was in South Africa, fought against apartheid, was so hardcore that Nelson Mandela at one point said he's a national security threat. Has a book out called Afro-Pessimism, which again came out a few months ago, and it's part philosophy, part memoir. It's a really, really remarkable story. Some of the book is so easy and so wonderful, and you can just absorb it. And some of it is so high level. I have read it and reread it 5 times, and I'm just kind of getting on. But we've got Frank next week. So thanks, everybody. Stay well. Go wash your hands, and we'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Claude.